Campus FM presents a talk organized by the Diocesan Commission for the Family on the Biological Statute of the Human Embryo by Professor Lopez Barahona.
Your Excellency, Mr. President, Your Grace, Monsignor Archbishop, Your Excellencies, distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen. On behalf of the Diocesan Commission for the Family, I would like to extend a very warm welcome to all of you who have kindly honored us with your presence. 10 years ago, that is in 1995, the servant of God, John Paul II, gave to the Church and to the whole world his 11th encyclical, Evangelium Vitae. It was the extraordinary consistory of the College of Cardinals, called by Pope John Paul II in April 1991, who actually felt the need that the Church should issue a document with its definitive teaching on the sanctity of life. The general relator of the consistory, Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger, today Pope Benedict XVI, said that the document should, on one hand, deal with the issue from the doctrinal point of view, and, on the other hand, it should be a joyful proclamation of life and not just a denunciation of negative aspects. Thanks to this encyclical, this evening we are gathered here to proclaim, to celebrate, and to serve life. Life is always a gift, and we are duty-bound to welcome it, to protect it, and to serve it in love. Modern society seems to have fallen into a trap because, on one hand, it is in favor of human rights and common good, and, on the other hand, it permits all sorts of attacks against life. The Pope teaches us that there cannot be a real and true commitment for common good unless we recognize and respect the right for life, upon which are founded all the other human rights. It is only respect for life that can guarantee a proper, democratic, and peaceful development of society. The protection and the promotion of life are the duties and the responsibilities of all. Catholic intellectuals are called to participate actively in favor of a new culture of life through serious and well-studied contributions. Legislators are called, through courageous choices, to promote and defend the value of life. Laws which disregard the dignity of the person undermine the very fabric of society. The Church, too, in the midst of a culture of death, has to continue through all its pastoral activity to foster and to promote in its communities a culture of life. This surely is not an easy challenge, but with the cooperation of each and every one of us, we can truly build the civilization of love and life, without which the life of individuals and of society itself loses its most genuinely human quality. And now I kindly invite Professor Monica Lopez Barahona, Dean of Biosciences at the University of Francisco de Vitoria, Madrid, to give us her lecture. Professor Barahona.
Excellence, Mr. President, Excellence, Bishop and Archbishop, ladies and gentlemen, first of all, I would like to thank the warm invitation of the Diocesan Commission for the Family of Malta to share with you this hour or less than an hour of talk on the issue of the biological statute of human embryo on the frame of the commemoration of the encyclical Evangelium Vitae. What I will try to do tonight is to give the scientific data that define the biological statute of human embryo, and also to address some of the problems that different techniques nowadays going on all over the world have on human embryo. As you all know, human embryo is formed after the fertilization of the egg, that is the germ cell of the woman, by the sperm that are the germ cells of the male. Once the egg is fertilized, the zygote is made. I know that at that very first point of fertilization there is some controversy that I will address in the next steps, but let me go on now. After the egg is fertilized, the zygote is made and it starts a development that ends in about 42 weeks with the birth of a girl or a boy. If we look to classical manuals of cellular biology, we may find in all the literature that a cell is defined as unity of life. Given the fact that the zygote is a cell, we may also define it as a unity of life. Recombinant DNA technologies have pointed out that it is possible to identify a human DNA without doubt in a blind test in a laboratory, at which we may have in different test tubes different types of DNA, and a scientist may be able to identify which one is human only because in human beings there are specific sequences at DNA double helix that are called ALU sequences. And I promise to you that that's going to be the worst word that I will say. From now on, I will try to make it very understandable. So we may identify the DNA, the genome of the human zygote, as human because of his ALU sequences. And as we have said that a cell is a unity of life, we may without doubt say that the zygote is human life. But that is also true for all the cells that integrate the human body. An egg, an sperm, a heart cell, muscular cell, is also a cell, is also a unity of life, and has also human DNA, so is also human life. What makes the difference that makes unique the zygote from other cells? The difference is that the zygote is the only cell able to develop to the 120 tissues that integrates the human body and to develop the 250 cell types that integrate the human body. All these tissues and all these cell types are contained in the primary zygote, because if they were not there, they won't be later on in development. So after the fertilization of the egg becomes a new entity that is called zygote that contains all the cell types and all the structures that further on will integrate the human body. And it is contained in the zygote in the only way that it may be contained in a unicellular being. So if embryonic development is allowed and continues going on in a perfect planning, they will be the appearance of the different structures that will arrive till the end of the birth after 42 weeks of gestation of embryonic development. I pointed out to you that here, at the very first moment of fertilization of the zygote, there are some controversial points, as there are also some controversial points at the morulized status and also some controversial points at the blastocyst status. So we'll go little by little trying to answer at least partially some of the questions. In fact, after the fertilization of the egg by the sperm, there is this entity that is a fertilized egg that has the DNA of the male and the DNA of the woman that has not yet been recombined, and when it recombines, it becomes an entity that is diploid, and the egg before was haploid. So there are some question marks about whether this has the statute of a human embryo or not. The fact is that some manuals of embryology call it already zygote, and some others call it egg fertilized at pronucleus status. What is a fact and objective data is that this fertilized egg in pronucleus statute is a substantial different entity of the egg alone, because the egg alone only has 23 chromosomes. And just because it only has 23 chromosomes, it only may be alive for 4 to 5 days. If it does not become fertilized, the egg cannot live longer. As a matter of fact, when it is fertilized, it's a new entity that, if we allow development of this new entity, it will end up in a birth of a boy or a woman. Otherwise, I don't see any reason for the fertilization, for the in vitro fertilization clinics to freeze embryos at this status of development. If they were not convinced that when you transfer a fertilized egg in pronucleus status to the uterus of a woman, you will have a boy or a girl. So with this, I'm sure in the debate we may discuss longer that I just point out some data about the process of synergy. It is published for many groups, but I think one of the most well-done works is the Cernica Goetz group, that is a scientist that works in Oxford and that published in Nature and in journals that are well recognized among the scientific community, that this very first moment of fertilization, the moment at which the sperm penetrates into the egg, is determinant for the afterwards development of the embryo. And it is so determinant that it is through this point through which will be the axis of the first division. It says in this abstract of one of the many papers that some of you that are interested in the specific first days of development of a human embryo may check on the Medline. It says that the sperm entry position tends to lie at one end of the short axis along which cleavage will pass. And as you see in the next slide, taking out of this paper, with the red arrow is marked the place through which the sperm will penetrate the egg. And this dot line shows the axis that the egg fertilized will use for the first division. So it is not casual, the place through which the sperm enters the egg, otherwise is determinant for the axis that will start the first division. Works made by Cernica Goetz group and others pointed also out that from the very first division, for the very first cleavage, there is a commitment of differentiation in these two cells that integrate the two cellular embryo. As a matter of fact, one of these cells is committed to develop the external part of the morula and is a polar cell. And this other cell is committed to develop the internal part of the morula and is a non-polar cell. As I mentioned on the first slide, there is also some controversy regarding this status of morula, of the development of human embryo. And there is people that argue that at these very first days of division, the human embryo is not a well-differentiated or commitment entity, but is only a mass of cells, a non-differentiated mass of cells. The works of Cernica Goetz and other groups published in Nature pointed out that this is not true from the objective data point of view. They pointed out that there is a polar compromise from the very first cleavage moment, from one cell to two cells embryo, and that this polarity of the cells that integrates the morula are determinant for the further commitment of differentiation that these cells will have, as we will see further on. About 7 days after fertilization, the human embryo achieves the blastocyst state of development, another very controversial point. From the 7 day after fertilization till the 14th day after fertilization, it starts a process that is called implantation, is the time at which the blastocyst goes into the uterus of the woman, and therefore cannot be longer outside the uterus of a woman. So in the in vitro fertilization clinics, that is the maximum time at which a human embryo may be kept in vitro. After this time, they need to transfer to the uterus of a woman in order to keep him alive. The Warnock Committee in United Kingdom was asked to define the statute of the human embryo at this point, and especially in the 14 first days after fertilization. So there was an inform that was elaborated by the Warnock Committee that came out with a new term. They decided to call the embryo of the first 14 days of life pre-embryo. That was completely rejected by the scientific community, regardless their moral position, because it's not an accurate term from the scientific point of view. Pre-embryo is what is before the embryo, and before the embryo is the egg and the sperm, that are two cells that are well-defined in all the embryological embryology manuals. So Anne McLaren, the embryologist that was at the Warnock Committee, wrote a letter to Nature that is published and you may read, in which she rejected the term of pre-embryo, and she said that this term was generated because of pressures from outside the scientific community. Unfortunately, this term pre-embryo has been adopted in many regulations of the in vitro fertilization procedure. For example, in Spain, we still have the term pre-embryo in our legislation. So I know that now is a debate on the legislation of in vitro fertilization here in Malta, and I wish that you don't do the mistake of including a non-accurate term for an embryo of less than 14 days of life. The idea of elaborating, of generating this term, was just to give a statute different to the embryo of 14 days of life than the statute that will deserve the embryo of 15 days of life. So the aim of the regulation was to allow some experimental training and some research on the embryos from 1 day till 14 days of life, and therefore they need to generate this term that is pre-embryo. But as I said, the proper embryologist rejected the term and wrote a letter to Nature to make clear her position on the scientific community. Blastocysts are also now on debate, because on the blastocyst it's already clear that there is an extracellular layer of cells and an inner cell mass. This inner cell mass is integrated by the famous embryonic stem cells. So it is at this statute of blastocysts at which these embryonic stem cells are well desired for some laboratories in order to do some research with them. As I show in the next slide, from the inner mass of the blastocyst, It has been already done some experiments. Specifically in 1998 was done a couple of experiments in the United States with blastocyst of in vitro fertilization clinic, at which they just disaggregate the blastocyst, and with the disaggregation of the blastocysts and the individualization of the embryonic stem cells, the blastocyst die. And they culture the different cells by adding different factors. So the idea is to be able to produce in the laboratory the different cellular types that came out from the blastocyst through the three layers, endoderm, ectoderm, and mesoderm, and so on. This experiment was successful in the fact of finding some fibroblast cells and some blood cells and some muscle cells. The fact is that if we now have blastocysts that may use for research, is because they come out as a consequence of the in vitro fertilization technique. This is a video report of 1978 of the birth of the first in vitro fertilization generated woman, that was Louise Brown. At that time, it was demonstrated to the world and to the scientific community that by using eggs and sperm and trying to fertilize the egg in the laboratory and afterwards transferring the egg and fertilized to the uterus of the woman, the birth of a human being was possible. That was shown as a success of technique and science through the world, also has a huge amount of consequences that are not exactly in favor of the life of the embryo. I will try to address some of these consequences, and one of them is the one that derives from one of the most aggressive techniques of in vitro fertilization, that is the technique called intracytoplasmic microinjection. I will also show to you a video. And this technique is used when the male does not produce a sperm that is able to swim and to reach the egg. So this sperm will never be able to fecundate in a normal way an egg. However, by using in vitro fertilization technique, the pipette takes the sperm, okay, and with the needle goes into the external part of the egg. Enters to the cytoplasm and inserts the nucleus of the sperm into the cytoplasm. As you may see with this video, it is completely forgotten the possibility of the sperm entering through the normal place, and is clear that in the in vitro fertilization clinics, by inserting the nucleus of the sperm into the cytoplasm of the egg, before the syngamia is produced, they look for the generation of the embryo. So sometimes there is some difficulty in understanding how one may say this is not an embryo because still there is not the recombination of the DNA produced. However, we use this technique to generate an embryo that we will transfer it afterwards to the uterus. Another practice that is going on the in vitro fertilization clinics is what is being called the pre-implantatory diagnosis. When the couple that is submitted to in vitro fertilization technique is suspicious to have a genetic disease, what the in vitro fertilization clinic offers to the couple is what is called preimplantatory diagnosis. So the morula embryo is held with a pipette and the other one removes one of the cells of the embryo. It's obvious that some of the embryos dead, die at this time, and they analyze genetically this cell. If the genetic analysis shows that this embryo has the disease, then the embryo is discarded. If the genetic analysis shows that this embryo is healthy, then this embryo is transferred. That is probably the most aggressive way of selecting embryo in in vitro fertilization clinics, but the normal way of working at the in vitro fertilization techniques is by using what is called the quality test for the embryos. So those embryos that have 7, 8, 9, or 10 in the quality test are transferred or frozen, and those embryos that do not achieve this test are discarded. So we do not have yet biological parameter in order to determine whether an embryo is healthy or not. So this quality test is performed by morphological means, and is by looking at the division of the fertilized eggs and by looking how quick it divides, if there is a symmetry of the division, if it is a symmetric division, if the bubbles that are called vacuoles that are formed after the division are quickly reabsorbed, and if the color of the cytoplasm is not very dark, then the embryo is considered good quality, and it is transferred to the uterus of the woman. If these parameters are not accomplished, then the embryo is not considered a good embryo, and it is not transferred to the uterus of a woman. So those are some of the issues that the in vitro fertilization technique put on the table regarding embryos, but are not the only ones. And coming back to the state of blastocyst, I have to speak now about the possibility of using embryonic stem cells for research. As you know, is a huge debate all over the world that started in the United States and came to Europe. And this debate is focused on the possibility of using embryonic stem cells for research. So taking an overview of the recent history, we have to speak about the most famous sheep of the world, Dolly the sheep. Dolly the sheep, as you probably remember, was generated at Wilmuth Lab in Scotland in 1997, and it was published, the achievement, in Nature. The technique that was used to clone Dolly, I will try to explain in a very simple manner, was the following. Instead of fertilizing the egg of the donor sheep with sperm, what was used to fertilize the egg was a somatic cell. In this case, specifically, a breast cell of a pregnant sheep. Why that? Okay. As I mentioned on the first slide, the DNA of the zygote, contains all the instructions in order to develop the 120 tissues and the 250 cell types that integrate the human body. But this DNA, the DNA that my zygote had already 40 years ago, is the same DNA that now my blood cells or my hair cells or my heart cells or my muscle cells have. Exactly the same DNA, exactly the same genes. However, my blood cells generate only blood cells, my hair cells generate only hair cells, my muscle cells generate only muscle cells. Because when the cell is differentiated, a cell is differentiated, the genome has silent some of the genes and active some other genes, and the genes that are active are those that are necessary for the function of this specific cell. So in a pregnant sheep, a breast cell is committed to feed the born sheep. So the genome of this breast cell is very committed, has a lot of genes that are silent and a lot of genes that are active. Okay, what they do is they took those genes from a differentiated cell and they transfer it into the egg. That is the technique of cloning called nuclear transfer. So they fertilize the egg that whose nucleus was already removed, not with an sperm, and they didn't allow the recombination of the DNA of the female donor with the sperm of the male donor, but they fertilize the egg with a nuclear material of one already well-differentiated cell. And to the surprise of the scientific community, when this zygote generated by nuclear transfer was transferred to the uterus of a sheep after 277 trials, Dolly was born. So this DNA was able to reprogram all the genes in order to develop all the structures that integrate the body of the sheep. This is Dolly, that is genetically identical except for the mitochondrial DNA to the donor sheep, to the sheep that donates the DNA. That is what is called clonation by nuclear transfer. Of course, after Dolly the sheep was born, it was a boom of clonation all over the world, and the question that was on the table is, it is possible to do that with humans? And if it was possible, what for and which will be the applications for that? So now there are like two possible applications. One that is called the reproductive human cloning, that is to use this technique to as an alternative way of reproduction. But this may derive into what is called hybrid clones. This data that I'm showing to you here were not published in any scientific journal because there is no regulation that allows to perform this type of experiments, but it was announced in a Boston newspaper by the group that supposedly performed the experiment. The idea was to use egg not from women, but from female cows or pigs, and fertilize them with a somatic cell, with a human somatic cell DNA. And with this hybrid zygote, try to generate a human being. The newspaper reports that the experiment was stopped at the late morula stage. The ethical implications of that are so obvious that I don't think I should discuss any longer on that. Okay, and then there is the so-called therapeutic cloning. The therapeutic cloning is a combination of two techniques, of the technique used to generate Dolly the sheep and of the possibility of generating different tissues from different embryonic stem cells, as I showed in some slides before. The fact is that if there is a sick person that has a disease that may be treated by replacing some cells, some degenerative illness, nobody will certify that if we generate these cells by using embryos that are surplus embryos of in vitro fertilization clinics, these embryos are going to be immunologically compatible with the immune system of the sick person. However, if we generate the embryo with the genetic material of the sick person, and we allow the embryo to live only for 7 days to kill him afterwards in order to obtain the embryonic stem cells and generate the different tissues that may be needed to treat this illness, then we'll be sure that there is immunological, that there will not be immunological rejection. That is called therapeutic cloning. The fact of generating embryos with the DNA of the sick person in order to be able to treat some diseases. And this is the way it is sold all over the newspapers of the world. So there is a huge debate, as you know, about the possibility of using embryonic stem cells for treating diseased people. I will use the last time of my talk to address this possibility and to address the other possibility of using adult stem cells. There are different sources of adult stem cells: bone marrow, adipose tissue, placenta, umbilical cord, and umbilical cord blood. The better study are the cells that come from bone marrow, the so-called hematopoietic adult stem cells. In the bone marrow, cells that integrate our blood are generated. So there are stem cells that are precursors of the different cells that integrate our blood, are precursors of leukocytes, red cells, platelets, lymphocytes, etc. So those are one of the types of adult stem cells. There are also stem cells in adipose tissue and so on. Okay, there are conventional wisdom regarding adult stem cell therapies. Adult stem cells, they say, will be less useful therapeutically than embryonic stem cells because they are harder to grow in culture, they are less plastic and cannot differentiate into all cell types, and they will only be useful to treat a limited number of diseases. I will try to demonstrate to you, based only on scientific publications, that all conventional wisdom are wrong on all three points. Adult stem cells expand rapidly in culture, and this is one of the papers that relate this fact. They have a rapid double time, 20 hours, and I will not go into many more details, then afterwards in the discussion, if you want, we may address some of these points. Okay, so they are not harder to grow in culture. They are less plastic. I think that nowadays is under revision the plasticity of adult stem cells. It was in the classical manual said that the zygote is a totipotent stem cell because from the zygote derive all the cellular types, that the embryonic stem cells are pluripotent stem cells because from there derive different but many types of structures. If you remember the slide with the ectoderm and the mesoderm and the endoderm, from those layers that came out from the embryonic stem cells derive different type of structures, as different as muscle and blood cells, for instance, from the endoderm. And it was said that adult stem cells are multipotent. That means that one adult stem cell may only generate cells of their own lineage, meaning a bone marrow stem cells may only be able to generate blood cells, right? That is absolutely under revision now. And I like to show the next slide in order to point it out, this nice experiment. Now, an early stage embryo was inserted an adult stem cell that was a precursor of neurons. This cell was supposed to only develop into neurons. However, when you implant this cell, this neuronal precursor cell, into the late morula embryo, and this cell is labeled in blue, you may find all over the adult embryo cells that derive from this neuronal precursor. That means that in the proper environment, the precursor of a neuron may become precursor of different type of cells. Actually, it behaves as an embryonic stem cells. So this is not the other result, of course, that points out that embryonic
that in the permissive environment of the embryo, as at least some classes of adult stem cells appear to be just as plastic as embryonic stem cells. This paper was published in Science. So this wisdom about they are less plastic isn't true. And last but not least, we'll go to address this one. They will only be useful to treat a limited number of diseases. I will just point out some of the results of human clinical trials. Just to show you that adult stem cells have got good results in intracoronary transfer of autologous bone marrow cells, intracoronary infusion of peripheral blood stem cells show improved cardiac function and promote angiogenesis in patients with myocardial infarction. Intracoronary infusion of progenitor cells is safe and feasible in patients, and so on. Last time that I checked this website, 3WClinicalTrials.gov, that was when I finished preparing my talk, 19th October 2005. I check that there are now ongoing 428 ongoing clinical trials with adult stem cells. And there is no one clinical trial with embryonic stem cells. So again, the data that are published where scientists, people check at the Medline, at the clinical trials government, pointed to us that it is a fact that the adult stem cells may be used to treat some diseases, and that the field of embryonic stem cells, as at least as far as 19th October 2005, is only on the area of research, but not on the area of treatment. The diseases that are included in these 428 clinical trials are cancer, heart disease, multiple sclerosis, lupus, and juvenile rheumatoid arthritis. So, the embryonic, here is just a short summary of the effectiveness of adult stem cells in front of the embryonic stem cells. Of course, the most important ethical issue of embryonic stem cells is that embryonic stem cells are isolated from embryos that must be killed in order to isolate the embryonic stem cells. And just to enunciate one important issue regarding the biological and ontological statute of human embryo, and it's the fact that after in vitro fertilization techniques, there is a huge amount of human embryos that are frozen in the liquid nitrogen containers of many hospitals or in vitro fertilization units all over the world, and that the options for these embryos are very limited. You may either thaw them and discard them, or thaw them and use them for research. In any case, the embryo will die. You may keep the embryo frozen, and by keeping the embryo frozen, the embryo will eventually die, but it is obvious that it's not the proper environment, and it is an aggression to keep an embryo frozen in a container of liquid nitrogen. Or you may also promote the prenatal adoption for them. At least this one that has also many problems is an alternative for frozen embryos that will allow them to live. So with that, I will finish, and I will be happy to answer, if I may, the questions that you have. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Professor Barona, for your excellent presentation. And now, as Professor Hamsaras has said, it's time for interventions from the floor for observations, remarks, and also questions. One of our ushers will be with a roving mic, so that those who would like to speak, please raise your hands and we'll follow some order. Yes, please.
I must congratulate Professor for a very erudite exposition of what actually is a very difficult and intricate subject. I am a gynecologist by profession, and I can assure you that there is no greater miracle of life than the beginning of a human pregnancy. I've had occasion to deliver lots of babies, and every time one is left in awe and wonder at the magnificence of creation. In your introductory part, in the introductory part of your talk, you skipped a bit, and I would like to draw attention to the fact that some of the difficulties that one encounters with this problem is the confusion that exists between the term human being and the term person. Human being is a biological term, essentially. The term person is more philosophical and perhaps even legal, but we will stick to the philosophical part. Without meaning to be disrespectful to the church, I think the church does not have the competence of making statements about personhood. In fact, in its many documents, it does state that the respect which is due to the human embryo should start as a person, should start from the very beginning of human life, from the moment of conception. Now, one of the problems is this, that there is no such thing as the moment of conception. Conception does not occur in an instant. Conception is a process which has a beginning, an interval, and an end result. And the end result is the formation of the DNA, which individuates the embryo from all the other persons in this world. I would like you to elaborate on the status of the human embryo in the pronuclear stage, before the formation of the DNA.
Okay, thank you very much for your comments, and I will be happy to elaborate a little bit more on your question. Of course, after the recombination of the DNA that comes from the male and from the female, we have a completely new DNA that identifies genetically this individual, okay, this person or this human being. But at the moment at which, at the moment, of course, speaking about a moment is not an accurate word, but let me say in the moment, that the sperm lacks the tail and fuses the membrane, part of the membrane, with the membrane of the egg. The DNA of the male and the DNA of the woman are in a new entity that is not an sperm, that is not an egg, and that is a M plus N embryo, no 2N embryo, right? But when the first division of the embryo is achieved, as you know, this DNA already recombined is separated into two chromatids and is positioned in different parts of the cell. So the recombination is a very important step that develops or allow to develop a new unique human DNA that will stay with the person all his or her life on. But this moment of fertilization of the egg generates an entity that, if we allow the development to go on, will also end into the birth of a boy or a woman. So I don't see that it is critical, the point of recombination, for identifying a new human being or a new human person. I think that the substantial change is made at the moment at which the egg finishes being an egg and starts being an N plus N, in generic terms, entity. Because when the egg is only N, is only haploid, it has specific characteristics that don't allow him to be alive for longer than 4 or 5 days, as you will know. So it is a substantial change when there is only the presence of the genetic material of the father that allows the recombination among those genetic materials, and that allows and transforms the egg in a different entity that is not longer an egg because it will live for maybe 80 years. So that will be my comment on that.
My difficulty with that is that, philosophically speaking, you cannot conceive of an entity as an existing thing when it is still in formation, when it is still in becoming.
Okay.
Because it is DNA that gives each individual the identity that makes him the person he is.
Okay, thank you.
I agree with you, but this DNA, as you will know, is not the same DNA at the pronucleus state, it's not the same DNA at the zygote state, and it's not the same DNA at the morula or blastocyte state. However, we don't question whether a 2-cell morula, 4-cell morula, 8-cell morula is the same human embryo, right? So why should we question whether an N plus N fertilized egg is a human embryo if we allow the development to the end, it generates exactly the same?
Further observations, please, and remarks? There is one over there, please.
I'm a molecular geneticist, so my work is mainly on DNA, really. I would like to point out, and this is coming from a person who studies DNA, that we are not just DNA. The first cell consists of DNA and a number of other organelles and a number of other molecules within the cytoplasm. And these will identify the new human being. And they form an integral part of this human being, and they will have influence as to whether this human being will be healthy or not. So I think it is a mistake to focus only on DNA. The second thing that I would like to correct is that our DNA changes as we grow. It does not remain the same. So, but are we a different person because our DNA is changing? We are still the same individual.
Thank you very much for your comments. Actually, I agree with both of them. And regarding the first one, I have to say that the experiment of Dolly, for instance, pointed out clearly that we knew before. But as you well know, the DNA of the somatic cell that was used to generate Dolly was not able to generate Dolly there itself. It requires the environment of the cytoplasm of the egg, with all the organelles, with all the information, the molecular and cellular information that is there contained, in order to be able to reprogram and to generate all the structures. So we are not just DNA, and we are not only determined by DNA. Second comment, absolutely agree. I pointed out in a reductionist way when I gave my talk, in order to demonstrate that the, generally speaking, the DNA is kept all our life long with many changes, not only genetic but also epigenetic changes, and that when we reprogram, when we put the DNA in the proper environment, as it is the cytoplasm of an egg, it is able to reprogram and to generate again all the structures that integrate the human body. Thanks for the comments.
And there's another comment I'd like to make. You have mentioned a number of procedures that can be done in IVF clinics. I would like to point out that different IVF clinics have different protocols. So there isn't, not all clinics use freezing, not all clinics discard embryos, not all clinics do embryo grading. It is just to clarify, and one thing, science does do good things as well. So
I would like to comment on one point as well, that before the sperm and the egg meet, there are countless possibilities. But once the sperm and the egg meet, there is only one possibility, unless something goes wrong. And would it be correct to say that the process from the beginning, when the sperm enters the egg, to the end of our life, the process is one continuous process, or is it staggered into different processes? Isn't it staggered into different processes for us to understand, for our brains to understand them? When we study embryology and we study the growth of a human being, isn't it one seamless process from the moment the sperm enters the egg to the end? Because as far as I know as well, all our cells change, most of our cells change every 7 years, and even the material of our brains change, even though the cells remain there.
You're right, it's of course a continuous process that in order to be able to understand and to study, we divide in many different processes, but it is a continuous, integrated, well-committed process from the very beginning till the end of our life.
Max here, second row, please. Can you please present yourself? And thank you.
Good evening. My name is Paul Vincenti. I'm from the group Gift of Life, the Pro-Life group. I just want to clarify our view on something which the good doctor mentioned. I believe that it's extremely dangerous to begin discriminating against human life based on its stage of development. Once we begin from the very moment discriminating life because its stage of development isn't what we expect it to be, then the door is open to discriminate against life right through into abortion, because some people would agree at 6 weeks, no, 12 weeks, 24 weeks, where do you close the door? Life, the way I can explain it in layman's terms would be with dominoes, and I carry with these me a lot, but these dominoes with me often. If you stack up 10, 15, 20, 100 dominoes and you touch the first domino, the process is continuous. You expect all the dominoes to collide with each other and end up falling down, unless you intervene. Once you intervene, the dominoes stop falling. Therefore, you've stopped life. And that's my comment. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Just to illustrate a little bit more your comment, I have to point out here that there is a regulation of in vitro fertilization techniques in Europe, that is the German law, that is very restrictive. German law only allows to generate those embryos that are going to be transferred to the uterus of the woman. However, German law allows the possibility of freezing embryos at the pronucleus stage. So, as a matter of fact, when an embryo at the pronucleus stage is frozen, is because there is a chance for transferring it later on into the uterus of a woman and get her pregnant and develop and continue the embryonic development. So,
Honorable Dr. Asha, please.
Thank you for your exposition. I'm a member of parliament. I'm also president of the National Bioethics Committee. I agree with you fully that the 14-day issue is not an issue at all. This is the report coming out from the famous Warnock report in the United Kingdom. I must, however, differ with you on the matter of syngamy. I do not believe sincerely, and we discussed this in the bioethics committee, which is made up of a number of clinicians and pathologists and psychologists and also moralists. I do not believe that there is a human subject at penetration. I believe there is a human subject at syngamy. Process needs a subject. Without a subject, you can have no process, so one is not able to speak a process unless one has a physical subject. I don't think this is the place for me to go into details on this issue because it's very complicated, but the fact for me that the second meiotic division has not yet occurred and that the nucleus prior to the second meiotic division, the female pronucleus, is completely different from the female pronucleus after the second meiotic division, that means that the ontological status of the embryo is not constant. Another comment which I heard today here is that once the sperm penetrates the egg, it's not a real egg at that stage, it's still a secondary oocyte. The real egg occurs after second meiotic division. That is when the nucleus of the female is definite. It has discarded its second polar content, second polar body content. Prior to the fusion between the male and female pronuclei, penetration of the embryo need not lead to the development of a human being. There are many documented cases of invasive carcinoma, hydatidiform mole, teratomas, which develop from this case, which nobody argues at all. Nobody has any doubt that these are not human beings. You can get also processes of parthenogenesis, which are specific cases, which in fact all these cases do not have the inherent capacity to develop and to maintain constant ontological development. In view of these differences, and there are others that I wouldn't like to take up all the time, my personal position and the unanimous position of the Bioethics Committee in Malta is that the position should be syngamy. However, we are not diverting from the process of conception, as Dr. German, who is also a member of the Bioethics Committee, very clearly said, this is still part of conception.
Thank you.
As you well pointed out, it's going to be a long discussion in which you may show the data and I may show the data arguing on that. So I will suggest to you openly, if you like to discuss deeper, because as the position of the Bioethics Committee of Malta is this one, but there are other committees, there are other scientific positions, there are other papers published in prestigious journals that are in favor of giving the statue of human being and human person at the embryo at the stage of pronucleus. So I will be more than happy, if you like, to discuss online and to exchange this information, not in order to convince you or that you convince me, but in order to look together toward the truth. That is only one.
Our Lord, the Archbishop, yes, please.
I would like, first of all, to thank you and to express also my pleasure that so many of us are so interested in scientific studies. it is a pride on our part. Because as you said and explained, I could not follow scientifically everything you said. I am not versed in science. I could not follow. But I thank you for what you said, because I got a glimpse of what you meant to say. But what you said meant also, from a scientific point of view, that there is different views on one, when life begins. There is a class of scientists who say that life begins as soon as the spermatozoa touches the ovum. And then on that point, automatically, another stage and stages of activities take place until the end. And the end is a human person. There is other persons, also who are versed in science, who teach the opposite, who teach that life, and that means life does not begin at the moment of fertilization, but after the zygote, after certain days, after the end of fertilization, of the process of fertilization. This is a fact. And on this fact, there is no discussions, as far as I know, from a scientific point of view. There are these two views. But in front of this situation, we have a fact, scientifically produced. And the problem is how we are to look upon it, how we are going to treat it. If I have something in hand, the first question that props to my mind is, what is it? I am going to treat it. I'm going to rub it out or to try to cultivate it. And the church, as has been well said, has no competence at all to delve into scientific problems and investigations. She may have persons, as she has also in fact, that hold on scientific points of view a good standing as others, but it is not her competition at all. And he disclaims this competition, but once there is something produced in a way or another, there is the possibility, not the possibility, the necessity of how you are going to behave in its relation. What are the relations that has been created between what has been produced scientifically or in a scientific way and the action of the person itself? And morally, the church has the right and the duty to express her views. To express her views means that morally she has the right to do it. Scientifically, she has no competence, she has no right to mix with other scientific problems. It's not her duty. But morally, she has the right to say clearly, without any doubt, that in this situation, which is the situation, there are two different views of where life begins, of when something that has a human nature begins, and in the state of doubt, it is inserted, ingrained in ethical principles, that you have to do nothing when there's a doubt about a person, about a human nature. Do you know what I mean? I said this in Malta. I said this, mind you, what I found. I did nothing out of it, you know? And we are bound to abide by this, notwithstanding all the discussions that are taking place. Scientifically, we are free to discuss. But on the point of view of morals, the church has the right and the competence, and nobody competes with it on this ground, that it is morally immoral. Why? Because we are here dealing with a human nature. With a human nature. Do you know this? Am I clear? This is what I am saying. And this is a proof, a principle, which is found in ethics. and not philosophy. It's called truism. Tutsiorism in the Latin word. Tutsiorism means when you are in doubt, and what is in jeopardy is a human nature, you can't make use of the human nature to cure another one. You can't make use of a human nature, think of a human nature, by using it as an instrument in other practices, you know, fertilizing and so forth. So that I think, although we are glad that science is making a great progress, and we have also to encourage it, in fact, I have students here in Maltese who have gone to Rome to study also science upon these facts, because the bishop has to be fed. Has to be fed. And this is a great asset even on the diocese, has to be fed. But, morally, it is a fact. Truism, what is it? When there is a doubt that there is a person there, you can't endanger this person. And if you allow me just 2 minutes to say how this principle is has been explained hundreds of years ago. A hunter, when he goes hunting, he is full of zest and eagerness to hunt. If he sees at a distance, behind a wall, that something is moving, if something crosses his mind that there might be a person, and not another creature, he can do it. And it is a fact. Some years ago, recently, in Gozo, a brother killed his brother. They were both together, went hunting, and one of them anyhow went away from his brother. The other one said it was ready to fire. And he saw something in the distance and thought that it might be some heavy fire. And found that it was his brother. His brother. That means that morally he has this principle, which is beyond, I say, controversy. As far as moral principle is concerned.
Thank you, Your Grace. Thank you. Are there further observations? Mr. Castarto Reggiani over here.
Thank you for a very interesting talk. A lot of interesting scientific information. I wonder if I can ask a question on the human level. Being a scientist in this field, when, as a Christian, when you reflect on the virgin birth, and when you reflect on the Holy Trinity, do you find joy in the progress of your science, and do you find in that joy great moral light for the secular society we live in to avoid killing on the one hand for the sake of pleasure, or to make the error of trying to find life where there isn't?
I'm needing a little bit of translation because...
Just repeat it very slowly, very briefly, and your question will be the last one. Your remark, slowly.
I'm sorry, but my English is good for science, but not for Holy Trinity, so if you may just repeat it for me slowly, and I'll be happy to answer. Sorry.
The English I want to use is for you as a person, as a scientist, in marveling at creation and nature. Have you found a deeper reflection as a Christian on the virgin birth? That's the first question.
I mean, when I contemplate the beauty of our life and the beauty of the world as a scientist, as a Christian, as a Catholic, first there is an attitude of gratitude for having chosen to be here and to be alive. Sensors of gratitude, because I believe that this is only the beginning, and the love does not have end, because if it will, it will not be true love. So we will enjoy much longer afterwards. And the higher expression of love is Holy Trinity. So my reflection on the love of God through us that created us and that wants us to be with Him in eternal life has His maximal expression in the Holy Trinity.
And
thank you very much for your reflection. With this reflection, we come to the end of our session.
You have just listened to a talk organized by the Diocesan Commission for the Family on the biological statute of the human embryo by Professor Lopez Barahona.